and Peter, the floor is yours.
Okay, great. I appreciate you all being here and for being so gracious with me for being late to get here. My apologies again. And I guess the other, as we jump into this, Dan, questions, I'm assuming at the end, do you also take questions throughout? I'm happy to do that as well.
No, Peter, what we usually do this very informally, and so you can't see our hands getting raised. But if somebody has a question, they'll just try to politely interrupt you, and you can manage your time with your answer. I hope that's okay.
Yeah, that's great. I would love to have the questions and dialogue as we go through this. That I know a lot of these folks on the line, and there's some really smart people here that probably know this better than I do. So I'm anxious to hear your thoughts and questions as we go through. So I'll try to pause and do that. Please ask as we get into this. I've got really two things here that I wanted to walk through with you all. One is just a view from my vantage point of where this whole small satellite revolution is at and what's causing it. As I said, many of you know this better than I do, so let's have a dialogue about that. And then as we get into the end of the charts here, I've got some specific details about what we're doing here at Spaceflight Industries and the direction that we're actually going and how we think we're fitting into that revolution as well. So I'm really anxious to hear your thoughts and feedback. So let's jump in. So chart two, I think the question that I really started with was, what is causing this small satellite revolution to take place? And if I jump to chart three, whenever I think about a space mission, I always think about it in this context of the three important segments to put the whole mission together. And that's the space segment, the piece that actually goes into orbit. That's the launch segment, the thing that got you there. And ultimately, probably the most important part of that that's often invisible to everyone is the ground segment. And how do you actually get the product off that spacecraft and out to the hands of users that care about it? And when you think about each of those segments, there are some major changes that are happening that are all coalescing together that are really enabling this revolution to occur today in small satellites and the way we operate in space. The first of those, of course, is Moore's Law. And Moore's Law is now coming to the satellite world. And the developments on our smartphones and laptop computers have miniaturized electronics and miniaturized memory chips and devices and radio systems and GPS receivers that are really enabling satellites today to be almost an order of magnitude lower in size, weight, and power and cost than the satellites I was working on in the U.S. government only, you know, a decade ago. And you can see this in a lot of programs that have been done out there. There have been the PhoneSat programs at NASA Ames that have literally taken smartphones and built CubeSats around them. The second thing that really enables that industry, then, is not just designing these very small spacecraft, but actually being able to launch them in a very easy way. And that's through this idea of containerization and the revolution that's really come about from CubeSats and being able to put a satellite inside of a box. And so you take a lot of risk out of that launch equation from the primary payload that is worried about that satellite coming apart on orbit, and also being able to put these boxes on a lot of different launch vehicles and moving these satellites around very easily across these launches. We'll get into this in a bit, but here at Spaceflight, we are one of the launch brokers in the world, and we buy excess capacity on the international market and resell it to secondary satellites. And we're at a point now in the industry where we can pretty easily move containerized spacecraft around from launch to launch within about a six-month window of the launch itself. And that's becoming pretty commonplace that at L-minus 6 months, if one of these small satellites doesn't make it, we can slide somebody else in. And because it's all containerized, the mass properties are the same, the stiffness properties are the same, they're containerized in a box, so we don't worry about them coming apart. And we have an agreement that we all launch powered off, so there's no EMI and EMC issues on the rocket. And it makes it really easy, and it makes it easier for these systems to get up and get launched. And then finally, the ground piece of this, we'll jump into these in some of the charts, but the development of cloud-based processing has really revolutionized the space operations business. When I was in the U.S. government and I was running satellite launch programs, I could generally take my budget and break it up into thirds. A third of the budget went into the satellite, a third of the budget went into the launch itself, and a third of the budget went into the ground system to manage the data and disseminate the data. That last third has almost disappeared. Back in 10 years ago, you had to stand up your own data center and go buy your own computers and network equipment to do that. And today, you can buy those data centers for literally hundreds of dollars a month. It's so cheap, it's almost free. So let's jump into this just a little bit. Chart 4, I thought this was really fascinating that Clyde Space of Scotland is working with a private U.S. foundation to put together a small CubeSat. And this foundation is, I'm blanking on the guy's name, the Roger Moore, the guy that coined the Moore's Law, in fact, is helping bankroll this small CubeSat. So how's that for poetic circularity that the guy that from Intel that helped accelerate this whole industry is now seeing it applied directly into the satellite business? And so there you can see a small 3U CubeSat sitting on a lab bench next to a laptop. And you can see this miniaturization of electronics in play right there. And then on chart 5, this is the idea of containerized launch, that you can put these dispensers on any launch vehicle and easily put a small CubeSat like that in there. These are CubeSat dispensers that we use on a lot of our launches provided by ISIS in the Netherlands. It holds 4 3U CubeSats, and you can very easily and quickly integrate these things. And as we talked about, just break this whole couple loads issue and break this one rocket, one satellite equation. And then finally on chart 6, this is a screenshot from the Spaceflight Industries webpage. If you go out to our webpage today, you can go to this site where you can go to our launch tab, and we have a list of launches that we've pre-negotiated space on. In different launch inclinations, different orbits, and we've got a price list there that shows you sort of a commercial list price for what it would take to get these satellites into orbit. And we're able to broker these things up and do large, complex rideshare missions like this one, the ESPA ring that Joe Maley knows so well. This is our first Sherpa launch. It's slated to go on a Falcon 9 out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. You can see the original schedule there sometime early first quarter 2016. We're now looking at, I think, probably first quarter 2017, given the recent issues that SpaceX has had. But this is pretty fascinating in itself, in that on this one ESPA ring, there are 89 separating spacecraft. And each of those blue boxes that you see there is one of those quad pack dispensers that holds 4 3U CubeSats. And so we have a combination of CubeSats and microsats here that will be put into orbit with the SpaceX Falcon 9. It'll separate the primary satellite off the top of here, and then it'll separate us and we'll become a free flying object in space. And then our sequencer starts up and starts sending commands to each of these satellites to separate into their own orbits. So maybe I'll pause right there before we talk about cloud processing. Any questions or comments about any of that? And again, I know many of you have worked this even more than I have. So thoughts?
Hi, Peter. Quick question about this ESPA ring and all the satellites you're launching off of it. Is that, I didn't want to do the math, but I figured you probably have. It's something like, a couple hundred kilos of small spacecraft are being launched off of this in addition to the primary?
There are. I wish I knew the number off the top of my head, and Joe Maley actually may know it. It is on the order of, I want to say, total mass here is about 350 kilograms. Joe, does that sound close?
It does. I don't know exactly either. Sorry.
That was just sort of for scale. And then do you sequence them to avoid collisions and things like that, or are they, you have delta Vs and you're comfortable that there's collisions aren't a problem?
Yeah, we do. So that's a big issue, obviously. And what we do here is we do sequence them. We've set these up to deploy on 30-second timers. And we have them set to deploy alternately on different directions coming off the ring itself. And then in conjunction with that, the ring itself is actually free-floating in space and will be slightly tumbling as we come off of the Falcon 9. And we've done quite a bit of analysis looking at recontact, and that tumbling motion and the sequencing, the steps at which we sequence actually help give you a small out-of-plane delta V to avoid recontact back at that separation point for each of these systems. So we've run the models out pretty far as the models really hold up, which isn't really that far before atmospheric drag and those perturbations will take over and make it a very stochastic series of events. But as far as the models run out, we have a pretty good confidence we don't have recontact here.
And then one last question that's related is, do you wait before you power up and have so that, or are they, or the channels, the communication channels, such that there's no RFI, and once they're powered
yeah.
up, they're powered up?
Yeah, that's a great point. Everything is launch powered off. So all the satellites on this ring are launch powered off. The ring itself is launched powered off. We get a SEP signal once we separate from the Falcon 9. That separation event commands our avionics to turn on, and that starts our sequencer system on a set time sequence. We wait for the rocket to do a collision avoidance maneuver. It's a fairly lengthy time. I'm going to say it's a 20-30 minute window there, and then we power on and we start deploying each of these satellites at that time. Then each of the satellites is powered off, and it gets a signal when it either is separated from the SEP ring or ejected from the CubeSat dispenser. There's a SEP switch in there that indicates it's been separated, and it also goes through a wait sequence and then powers on.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, good. Yeah, great question. Thanks. Any other thoughts or questions about that? Okay, so what that really means is that the launch part of the equation is really becoming a commodity. We like to say, in effect, that flight services is really the world's first spaceline, and what we really advertise to our customers are just like an airline or a train ticket. We advertise a schedule and a price list, and if you want to get access to space, you can just sign up on one of these launches coming up. And we'll take care of everything, sort of like FedEx, and you ship us your satellite, and the next time you hear from it, it's beeping and squeaking on orbit. So if we jump to Chart 8, talk just a little bit about the economics of the ground architecture itself. I thought this was a pretty fascinating sort of assessment of pricing of cloud-based services. And this really is enabling a lot of startup companies in this sector. Like I said, when I was launching satellite missions like this on the U.S. government side, we would easily spend a couple million dollars, maybe even tens and hundreds of millions of dollars building out the data center for the satellite itself. And now you can buy these kind of cloud-based both processing and databasing data storage capabilities for literally hundreds of dollars a month. And you can see on Chart 8 some economics of what it would cost to go out and build your on-premise system versus a cloud system for sort of a very nominal data center capability. And it's orders of magnitude. This is a 90% cost savings in that first year of operation. And that's really important to a startup company when your capital is so incredibly important, and being able to preserve that capital and get up and operating in the early years. So this is really enabling, and I see it both in our business with Black Sky as well as a lot of the companies that we're working with in this sector. The other part of the ground architecture itself is building out the satellite ground station networks. this is also becoming sort of widely commoditized. We have our own offering here at Spaceflight Networks. You see on chart 9, we're building out a network of ground stations around the world, of UHF, S, and X-band links. We have specified 17 of these sites that we're going to build out between now and 2019. We built out 3 of these sites this year. You can see our site in New Zealand, a dish we've leased in Fairbanks, Alaska, and a UHF site we built out here in Seattle that we're operating today. On the picture on chart 9, the yellow circles are UHF sites that we have identified where there are either existing antennas or spaces we could easily put an antenna. And the blue circles are also are places where we could put S-band and X-band dishes like the one you see in the New Zealand picture. Or in some locations, places where there are existing antenna dishes that are not being used that we can get access to and roll into our network. And so just in the same way that we advertise commercial launch services, we advertise commercial satellite ground station services. And if you go to our webpage, we list the UHF service at $1.95 a minute and the S and X band links at $19.95 a minute. And we have a list of radio vendors there that have built radios that sort of work out of the box with our ground stations. Sort of like a Verizon plan, if you will. You can go into the Verizon store and walk out with a phone, and that phone works automatically with the network. And the same way, you can come to Spaceflight and we'll offer you a launch. We can give you a radio that works, and you take that radio, turn it on, and it will work essentially out of the box with our ground station network. So all those things really are driving down the complexity and the cost of getting your satellite into orbit. And so those three things together, the Moore's Law coming to space, containerizing of launch, commoditizing the ground architecture, are really enabling this revolution in small satellites that we're seeing. So questions about any of that or comments from anyone?
Question about the ground networks. How are you handling spectrum allocation, since that's getting more and more of a problem, especially with federal regulation? Do you have your own allocations, or does each satellite have to still do that?
Yeah, we're working through that. Today, every satellite has to go get their own allocations. And so that's what we're doing. It is complex. I think, you know, people are talking about blocks of frequency allocation and moving to that kind of environment, and I think we'll get there. And the other thing that I think will sort of transform this sector, which I didn't include in my charts, but are things like optical comm, where you can get away from a lot of the frequency restrictions that we have and get to very high bandwidth uplinks and downlinks. And that's a technology that I also think is on the horizon that's going to be really game-changing. But, yeah, that's a good question. And the whole regulatory aspect of this whole small satellite revolution, I didn't really spend a lot of time in my charts on, but we could have a long discussion about space traffic management and conjunction risks and orbital debris and frequency management, all big challenges to this sector. Any other questions or comments? Okay, so once you basically set the premise that these technologies are enabling these small satellites to be built and launched at orders of magnitude lower cost and complexity, the question has to come into your mind, what do you actually do with them? And what's the market for these small satellite systems? So if we jump to chart 11, this is really my opinion, and it's my opinion based on maybe 20 years of working on satellite missions inside the Department of Defense, that the real big bet here is about global real-time intelligence. And in the commercial sector, it's about market intelligence. In the sort of military and defense world, it was about maybe persistent surveillance and intelligence about what's happening in our security environment. But in my view, this is really like in some sense, a peace dividend that comes after a significant conflict in which a lot of those technologies find their way out into the commercial sector. And what we learned over the years, the last couple decades of security and defense operations, is that persistent surveillance and communications fundamentally changes the game. And this is what's really fueling this idea that we can build small satellites to monitor the globe in near real time and the communication networks to bring this information back. And we can use this network of information to really change our perspective of the planet for the betterment of society. And if you look at the next couple charts, chart 12, we can start talking about a couple use cases. So what would you use these satellites to do? Well, use case number one is to monitor oil production around the world. This is a pretty important problem, and oil security is a big driver in market economies. It's a big driver in conflict around the world. And it's well known that you can use satellite imagery to see containers and what containers are full, and even calculate how much oil is being stored in every container, and give you a really good idea of what's happening in the world oil supply and energy supply. On chart 13, there are companies out there that put information like this together, and they put together reports and indices that you can subscribe to that tell you what the oil security risk is at any one point around the world. So knowing this information in near real time and a global look on this information is very important to people that monitor this kind of security and market information. The case point two, switch to chart 14, monitoring logistics of materials and products moving around the globe are also very important. Here's some satellite imagery of a port in New York, and you can see a container ship being unloaded, and there are actually algorithms that use satellite imagery to count these containers in these ports, and you can come up with really good ideas of what the economy is doing in a certain part of the world. On chart 15, I've been fascinated to track this company called SpaceKnow, and they use satellite imagery to monitor something like 6,000 sites around China, and they can come up with an estimate of what the domestic production is in a certain quarter in a region of the world like that that has a really significant impact on the world economy. So this is another really important example of using satellite imagery, small satellites to collect this and do it in near real time and feed it into this kind of knowledge-based economy. The last one that gets a lot of play, this is also really fascinating to me, growing up on a ranch in Wyoming, precision agriculture and monitoring agriculture production around the world. Our own company, Spaceflight Industries, with our partnership and acquisition of OpenWare, we have some contracts to monitor crop production this growing season. And you can use satellite imagery to monitor nitrogen deficiency in crops. And we can actually calculate a map of the field on essentially a 1 meter grid that shows you what parts of the field have what levels of nitrogen deficiency. And then you can download that map directly into the tractor, and using a GPS signal and GPS-based map in the tractor, the fertilizer spreader can change the level of the amount of nitrogen that's spread on that field on each 1 meter grid. You can tune the actual amount of nitrogen to optimize the crop production in that field. Really fascinating and a really growing area of application for this kind of product. So before I jump into what is spaceflight doing here, any questions about that part of it? Or comments about it, or maybe other use cases? Okay. So the last section of the brief, I thought I would touch just a little bit on spaceflight industries and what we do here and how we fit into this revolution. So if you hit chart 18, this is a high-level summary of us and our company. The company has actually been around since about 1999. We're headquartered up in Seattle. It was started by Jason Andrews, used to be known as Andrews Space, and over the last couple years, we've merged a number of different initiatives together, and this summer, we pulled together all of these things under one corporate umbrella called Spaceflight Industries. We have about 130 people today, spread out over two locations here in Seattle as the headquarters, and then merged with OpenWare in Herndon, Virginia. And so we have about 35 people in our office there. Essentially, our business is about revolutionizing access to space through our Spaceflight brand, and then through our Black Sky brand, operating this platform and analytics infrastructure to really understand the world in near real time and feed that information into customers who will do things like monitor oil production and commodities production around the world. If I hit chart 19, we'll talk a little bit about the launch part of the business first. We continue to break a number of launch records. We've launched, I think, brokered launches for about almost 100 satellites. We'll certainly be at 100 satellites by the end of January. We have a backlog of about 150 satellites on contract today that we're providing launches for. We have enough capacity that we bought a dedicated Falcon 9 this last year to do rideshare missions on, and we're putting all that mission together to launch late next year with about 89 satellites on that launch as well. And we launch on rockets all over the world. We do a number of launches with customers on the Indian PSLV rocket. We have a contract to fly the first commercial spacecraft to the moon. We put our services on GSA, so just like the government can buy pencils and paper, you can buy a launch service on the GSA schedule. And if you hit go to chart 20, you'll really see the schedule and pricing that we use there. This is, again, a screenshot of our webpage. But if you navigate to that webpage and look at our launch price list, this is basically what we advertise publicly, and we can usually beat that price. And this is very similar to the schedule we have on GSA. The next chart shows some of the launches that we're working on today. The SSOA mission on the left-hand side is the stack that we're working on right now for our first dedicated Falcon 9. And you can see we're moving up in complexity there from a single Sherpa system built on the ESPA ring to multiple ESPA rings and other adapters. Carrying a large number of spacecraft to orbit. We're doing this beyond sun-synchronous low Earth orbits. We have some GTO missions lined up that you see in the next solid model there, and then some follow-on missions in low Earth orbit as well. We think we have enough demand that we'll probably do one of these missions a year from here on out into a sun-synchronous orbit like SSOA. So questions about that before I jump into the next part of our business?
Well, yes, this general question I have about the fact that with this blossoming of information communications on, are you facing any issues with privacy? When, for example, at all levels, for example, when you showed that information about manufacturing in that area of China, and everybody knows the Chinese government manufactures its own statistics and so on and so forth for political purposes. Now, this independent assessment may occasionally have a conflict with the China, with the Communist Party in China. Would you expect any retribution or any conflict? Just as an example, but more in general, the question of disinformation and the privacy violations that are bound to come out.
Yeah, I think it's a really important question and something that we have spent a lot of time here at Spaceflight Industries thinking about and talking to the community about. We view this as all technologies have two edges to the sword. And, in one way, democratizing access to the information you can get from space really helps people all across the world hold bad actors accountable. And so it's a very beneficial thing for society to have access to that. On the other hand, as you said, there's these privacy concerns and privacy issues, and finding the right balance and making sure that, as these technologies come online, they're used for the greater good and not the greater ill, I think are very important to us at Spaceflight. I think it's important to the whole small sat sector, in fact, the whole commercial space sector. To be more specific about it, our own imaging satellites, which I'll talk about here in just a minute, we've made a conscious choice that we will probably not go below 50 to 75 centimeter resolution. And part of that is, one, we think that monitoring global economic activity, you really don't need greater resolution to do that. And secondly, it also gives individual people a certain level of privacy. You can't tell a specific person in a satellite image at, say, 75 centimeter resolution. But that's a really important question, and certainly something that one company like ours doesn't have the answer to, and we as a community are going to have to find the answer collectively. Other thoughts about that or questions about that?
Yeah, Peter, this is Rand Simbert. Are you looking at all beyond Earth orbit?
Yes and no. In our launch business, we certainly are. As I showed in chart 22 there, we are doing some GTO missions. We have a couple contracts to take satellites to lunar escape mission as part of the Google Lunar X Prize. So, yes, from a launch service, we definitely are. Our satellite business today is certainly focused on monitoring global activity, Earth activity, and so it's very much LEO-focused.
Peter, Steve Brody, could you just say a brief word about the significance of the adjective dedicated in dedicated rideshare and what it means in terms of competition out there?
Yeah, I can certainly comment about dedicated. What dedicated means for us is we bought the entire capacity of a Falcon 9 to do the rideshare mission on. And it's really the stack you see on chart 21 there in the left-hand column, the SSOA mission. So that's a full Falcon 9 capacity. Up to now, our business has been just buying excess capacity on rockets. So we would buy, you know, sort of a quarter or half or a third of the leftover space. But this is the first time we bought a full dedicated rocket to do it. What does it mean for competition? I'm not sure how to address that question, or maybe ask it another way.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Well, let me spend just a couple minutes showing you what we're doing in the Black Sky business on chart 22. So we are basically trying to help catalyze this geospatial revolution by building out what we sort of refer to as the Bloomberg Terminal for Space. And by that, we mean this multi-sensor platform fed with small satellite data that allows our customers to really understand the planet in real time. And we sort of view this as the next geospatial revolution as we've moved from the paper maps I grew up with to Google Earth that my kids are growing up with to ultimately seeing Google Earth in real time and, you know, 24/7, every spectrum monitoring what's happening in the Earth. So to do that, we're building out a constellation of small satellites. Chart 23 shows you what that sort of initial roadmap looks like. These satellites are about 50 kilograms in total mass. Our Pathfinder 1 satellite is on orbit today. We launched it 30 days ago today. And it carries a small 24-centimeter class telescope on board that gives us approximately 1 meter resolution color imagery of the Earth. These satellites are built to live about 3 years on orbit, and we've specified a 60-ball constellation. And our plan is to launch roughly 20 of these a year, and by the time we get the full 60 up, the first block of 20 will be degrading out, and we'll launch another block of 20. So we have this continuing technology upgrade path. And you can see with the system here on chart 23, we're building the Pathfinder 1 satellites. They're built, ready to launch now. Pathfinder 1's on orbit. We're building the Block 2 system now. We're already starting to work on Block 3 payload designs. And so we'll just start rolling these out every year, a new generation of spacecraft coming on orbit. Until you see on chart 24, we get to the full 60-satellite constellation on orbit. And we plan to put these in a variety of inclinations so we get rapid revisit rate across the entire globe. And if you see on chart 25, we call this our heat map of revisit rate with that 60-ball constellation across the globe. You can see that in many parts of the world, we can revisit 60 to 70 to 80 times a day. And the bumper sticker we like to put on this constellation is that we will be able to take an image of any spot in the planet and send it back to you on your iPhone in under 90 minutes for under $90. So if you have a vacation house somewhere and a hurricane blows through and you want to see if the roof is still on, you'll be able to log onto our webpage, onto our platform, give us your credit card and the lat and long of the target that where your house is, and we'll collect it and send the picture back to you on that webpage in 90 minutes for $90. And so that really leads me to the next part of the chart, which is kind of this transformation of how you get access to satellite imagery, and this 90 minutes for $90 on a very customer-friendly web-facing portal. And so that was part of our teaming with the OpenWare company on Chart 27, really building out this platform where we can allow our customers to get access to this imagery. And we realized that it was important to get not access to not just our imagery, but to all the imagery that you could get access to. So we're very eager to work with other companies out there like Digital Globe and Planet and Earthcast and Airbus and Skybox and anyone else, Astro Digital and small SAR providers. And then we realized that ultimately we want to feed all kinds of information into this platform and geolocate it so that customers can understand what might be happening in their area of interest in near real time in virtually every spectrum monitoring that region of the world. So we started pulling in social media like Twitter and Facebook. We're now pulling in newspapers from over 100 countries around the world and doing real language processing on those newspapers. We look at cell phone pictures that are posted on open websites, and we can geolocate all this information together and start creating a repository of essentially what's happening in the world geolocated on a map, and so customers can understand that. And so our platform on Chart 28 will really allow you to do that. It'll allow you to log in and get access to all that content, whether it's just visible imagery or if you want to add radar imagery or other things like AIS ship tracking information or ADS-B airplane information. And then once you have these data feeds, we can build algorithms that run on top of it to help you monitor events in certain areas that you might be interested in. So we've built out today a conflict monitoring algorithm that allows you to draw a watch box around a certain location in the world, and our algorithm will just continually monitor those data feeds for events that might be indicators that conflict is about to erupt in that region. So as an example, when the coup happened in Turkey here a couple months ago, our algorithm was running on all these data feeds, and very quickly, within about 15 minutes, we started seeing social media hits that something was happening in Istanbul. We started getting social media postings of military equipment in different locations within the city. And ultimately, what this tool will allow us to do is once those indicators are hitting on an activity, we'll be able to automatically task our satellite constellation to start collecting imagery of that scene and then feeding it into the platform for customers to understand really what's happening, as we said, in the world in sort of near real time. And so that's really it. That's the kind of spaceflight industry's view of what we do, from being able to launch satellites, design and build satellites, operate satellites, and then fuse all of that information into the customers to really transform the way we think about our planet and the way we view our planet and understand it. So that's it. If Chart 29, I'm anxious to take
Peter, Peter, this is Dan Lester. Harley had to step away, so I'll take over with the moderation, but I wanted to thank you. Sure. This is a really fascinating seminar you just gave, so thank you very much. We've got some time for questions. I'll start out with one. Which it's sort of half a question, half a comment. Spatial resolution, and you touched on this, but spatial resolution is really an important factor. And small sats just don't do high spatial resolution. And so you need to find, I guess, a commercial niche in spatial resolution, and it sounds like you've done exactly that. In fact, some of your pictures are really impressive spatial resolution-wise. I'm just wondering, you know, certainly there are defense applications for much higher spatial resolution. Are there commercial paths that would lead you to drool over larger telescopes? You know, certainly Pathfinder is pretty neat, but I mean, you know, telescopes 3 or 4 times larger than that.
Yeah, that's right. I think the answer is certainly, I'll give you 2 answers, Dan. I think for us, we believe that a lot of the economic monitoring that we want to be able to do can be done at the, you know, sort of 1 meter to 75 centimeter to maybe half meter range in resolution. Because if you're wanting to look at, you know, how many cars are in a particular parking lot or the oil level in a particular tank or the number of containers in a port, you can certainly discern that with resolution, with imagery of that kind of resolution. So then you have to ask, well, what kind of economic activity would I need to monitor, would I want to monitor that I need to get down to, you know, 25 centimeter resolution, which I think is the current legal U.S. limit. And one area that is fascinating to me that I hear a lot of people talking about is the connected car and autonomous automobiles and being able to keep up with road networks and provide real-time information into an automobile or into, you know, into the transportation network about road conditions. And you probably, you know, most certainly want to have better than 1 meter accuracy on your map for your car. And so that's an example where I think there's probably a lot of potential growth area. I may not be the best guy to answer others, but those are 2 that are certain.
No, that's fine. Yeah, I was just wondering if there was something that came to mind about higher spatial resolution. Like I say, it's pretty clear you found a really good commercial niche in the meterish spatial resolution, and that's wonderful.
I think, Dan, not to cut you off, but there's this other axis in the trade space, or actually 2 other axes. There's resolution, and then there's persistence and timeliness, and there's this trade between resolution and timeliness. And then there's another 3rd axis, which is spectral content, and, you know, what spectrum are you monitoring or looking in? And we think, in fact, there's great value in both, in all 3 of those axes, obviously, but there's a lot of a place to explore in the spectral content, and we think that persistence and timeliness is hugely important, and in the near term, timeliness is probably much more valuable than resolution.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much. Other questions for Peter?
Steve Brody here. Peter, fascinating. 2 quick questions. One is, at what stage or timing do you expect to be able to offer this, go back to your elevator talk, you know, 90 bucks, 90 seconds, whatever that number was. What time frame are we talking about? And have you had interactions that you could speak of with media companies that might want to be able to broadcast what's going on around the world on demand?
So 2 answers. The first question, how soon will we be able to image any spot on the planet in 90 minutes for $90? It really depends on us getting the 60-ball constellation built out. We are, as I said, we've built the first 2 satellites now. The first one's on orbit. We launched it about a month ago. The second one's ready to launch when SpaceX starts flying again. It'll go on, in fact, our first Sherpa launch. We're building an additional block of satellites right now that'll launch this next year. And then we're out testing the market to fundraise for the full 60-ball constellation. The business plan right now shows us having that completed by the end of 2019, early 2020. That's the first question. The second question, have we had interaction with media companies in this area? The answer is yes. We can't, it's not public yet. I think it will be shortly. But yes, we are working with some media companies who you know, as you would imagine, want to understand what's happening around the world in near real time.
Other questions for Peter?
Yeah, this is Tom Martin at Aerojet Rocketdyne. Could you talk a little bit more about beyond visible, what other spectral areas of might be of interest?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of Peter Wagner's personal opinion, so it's only worth that much, which probably isn't that much. But my personal view is that if, you know, this hypothesis plays out that there's all this value in monitoring the planet in real time, I think what we're going to see is this technology race, if you will, from doing this initially in the visible spectrum because it's relatively easy. I don't want to make it sound super easy, but it's relatively easy, to then moving into other spectrums like the infrared domain, getting into hyperspectral sensing. There's a tremendous amount of value in precision agriculture and hyperspectral sensors. A lot of that work's being done with airborne sensors today. We've talked already about monitoring in the RF domain with things like AIS and ADS-B. And I think ultimately what we will see are really hundreds, maybe thousands of satellites circling the globe and just monitoring the entire electromagnetic spectrum of emissions off the face of the Earth, and then feeding that into these big data machines that is running algorithms on them to really understand change and understand what's happening in the planet. So I sort of see it going that way. I see it going from visible imagery to very quickly moving into the other optical phenomenologies like a multispectral and hyperspectral, and then finally, and then a separate track with the RF technologies and monitoring RF emissions.
Doesn't monitoring the RF really get you into an interesting privacy territory?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely it does. And, you know, we've seen that in the commercial sector with Google developing Google Maps and monitoring those kind of things. So, yeah, absolutely it does. But that's where the world's going to go, you know. I mean, because it's not just a U.S. technology base anymore. These small satellite technologies are proliferating very rapidly around the world. And it's pretty easy to take a software-defined radio and build a pretty sophisticated RF monitoring sensor now. And I just don't think it's going to take a decade for people to figure that out.
Thanks. And I guess one follow-on question then. What if you kind of accept that 3/4 of a meter resolution is good enough for most things and doesn't invade privacy, and you get to a certain revisit time, 90 minutes or whatever, then do you say, I don't need any more satellites, more competitors up there providing the same data?
I don't think so. I think, what we see in our data portal, this fusion tool, is that more information is better. There's almost, you know, you almost want infinite numbers of data sources coming into that. I don't want to extrapolate it too far, but I don't think it's limited to, you know, just 60 satellites on orbit and then everybody else is out of business. I really do think it's literally hundreds and maybe thousands of satellites up there monitoring the planet in near real time. And to get to near real time on a global scale is way more than 60. And it's in all these different spectrums, from visible to infrared to hyperspectral to RF to, and I think we're going to learn a lot about our planet and about our activities around the planet, and it's going to be very valuable data. So I think there's a tremendous sort of opportunity there, and I don't think one company is going to be able to capture it all.
Cool. Thank you.
I mean, I would like to. It'd be nice if spaceflight industries could capture all that, but no, I don't think it's possible.
Anybody else have a question for Peter?
You allow me one more, Peter. I don't know if this is something that you've thought about or might want to think about. There's certain nefarious commercial activities going on around the globe, and one of those was researched by an ISU project a few years ago about illegal fishing, which came about because of an interest that expressed to ISU, and we did briefings to the Coast Guard and NOAA and others on the results, and the project came up with certain characteristics of what fishermen doing the wrong things are doing, how they do it, and how you could sense it from space. I'm not sure if that's currently in your use database, but be happy to share that report with you if you're interested.
Yeah, I would love to read the report. I think that's a classic example of how democratizing that access to space and the great capability you can get by monitoring events like that can really change things for the better. And so, yeah, I think that's a great use case. I would love to read the report.
Okay, I've got your email off the chart. I'll communicate.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, we're getting towards the end of the hour. Peter, I've got another quick one for you. I think it'll be quick. You were talking about your three success metrics, your resolution, revisit frequency, maybe spectral coverage. I was wondering to what extent comm bandwidth is another one. That is,
yeah.
You know, that's related to imaging format, how many pixels you got, and actually you can expand that to spectral resolution also. And what you need for bandwidth is antenna size and power. And you don't have those in a small sat. Do you ever find yourself sort of rubbing up against that limitation in what you do?
Yeah, great question. You're absolutely right. And this vision about moving from visible to multispectral and then hyperspectral, I mean,
right.
Gigabytes of data that you're trying to
yep.
move around. And, yeah, that's going to be very challenging. But, again, that's where I think I mentioned that I think optical comm, laser comm is going to be really interesting. And I think another fundamental game changer because it – allows you to work through that limitation of antenna size and power. And I think those technologies are probably just a few years off. And I think once they're able to be harnessed by this sector, it allows you to move massive amounts of data like that. So that's really important.
Yeah, in fact, you know, what you need for laser comm is really good pointing, but you already have a satellite that has fantastic pointing. So
yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Okay, that's really neat. Okay, well, we probably should bring this to a close. I just want to let everybody know we're going to do this again next week. Brian Whedon is going to be with us talking about a primer on space public policy. That would be really interesting. And I want to thank Peter again for the great telecon. Again, Peter, this is all going to go in our archive, and loads of people will download it and podcast and stuff like that. So
I look forward to being famous.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you all. Thanks.